This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. From the state's top leaders down to the dinner table, we're all coming to terms with what needs to be done to address the issues brought up in Black Lives Matter protests, from Detroit to Grand Rapids to Howell. We've talked on the show over the past couple of weeks about several pieces of this issue, from police training to community work to education in our state schools. Hidden from a lot of our eyes are the legal engines that can inform the structures of government and law enforcement. We wanted to get a better grasp on that framework and what the courts have said about police use of force. With us today is Tracy Brame, an associate dean at Western Michigan University Cooley Law School, Grand Rapids campus. She's a former public defender in Washington, D.C. and Detroit. Tracy Brame, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Eve Primus is with us as well. She's a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. She teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, and writes about structural reform in the justice system. Eve, it's very nice to have you as well.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to ask you both a little bit about the evidence you've seen that what happens in the United States court system has real influence on police conduct. Tracy, what comes to mind when you think about that question?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we were talking about the Supreme Court earlier, and as we saw with all the cases that the court has taken up, one of the cases they declined to take up was a case involving qualified immunity for government officials. And
I'm sorry to bust in, but just a little context for folks who aren't watching the law blogs. The high court actually declined to hear 8 separate cases involving qualified immunity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And Justice Thomas, who is typically considered to be relatively conservative, dissented from the court's action in those cases. But I'm interested to hear Eve's kind of history of how this kind of intersects with these cases that we see involving excessive force and police brutality, et cetera. But one of the issues with qualified immunity that we've seen come to the forefront is that while it was originally intended to give officials leeway to do their jobs without having to worry about lawsuits, to be able to make split second decisions, right, without having to think through the legal ramifications of it, what it's become, particularly as interpreted by the courts, et cetera, along the way, is basically a cloak that sometimes covers particularly police officers who are involved in misconduct. And so you might have, you know, cases in which a police officer uses excessive force, someone brings a case to court, and then, you know, we're caught in this catch 22 where the court says, well, you know, yep, you brought this case. I know you are arguing that your civil rights were violated, et cetera, but officer has qualified immunity, right? You know, as long as he was doing something, he wasn't doing something that he knew he shouldn't have been.
Right.
Right. As long as that he wasn't violating a right that we have already established as a right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So since we didn't say chokeholds weren't, you know what I mean? You know, we're violative of rights, you know, we're going to give him immunity in this case. And it's more complex than that, obviously, but that's just an example of the court's actions making a real difference.
Right.
Because it really is the court, the evolution of qualified immunity has come more through the courts than through the legislature.
Just for the layperson's definition, what we mean when we say qualified immunity is that police officers and police departments are immune from, say, damage suits in civil courts when use of force has either a lethal or a very serious consequences for the people that police interact with. Tracy, to see the Supreme Court say, no, we're not going to look at any of these 8 cases, do you think that means that qualified immunity will not get considered with the current composition that we see in this court?
Well, again, I saw the what happened as more of a, I mean, maybe a punt to the legislature, because one of the things, one of the many discussed reforms or suggested reforms that we've heard in the aftermath of George Floyd and other things that have gone on recently is this review of the role of qualified immunity in these cases. And, you know, we have our own West Side legislator, Justin Amash, who's calling for reviews of qualified immunity doctrine as well as others. So I think that at least in the near term, changes that happen in that area will come from the legislature as opposed to the courts.
Eve Primus, how would you answer this question? What evidence do we have that what happens in the courts has a real trickle-down influence in police conduct?
Well, I think part of the problem is that the Supreme Court has created some very amorphous tests for assessing when police use of force is excessive. So there's a series of cases that they've decided over time that date back to 1985, which was the first one. It was called Tennessee versus Garner. It was a case involving an 8th grade African-American boy who was 15 years old, who broke into a house and stole $10 and a purse from that house. And the police got a call and responded, and the boy was running away from them, and they shot and killed him. in order to prevent his escape. And the United States Supreme Court said in Tennessee versus Garner that that was an unconstitutional use of force by the police. But the holding that they issued in that case was actually quite limited. They said, if you have a suspect who threatens an officer with a weapon, or if the officers have probable cause to believe that the suspect has committed a crime that involves the infliction or the threatened infliction of serious physical harm, then the police can use deadly force. And so it left a lot of unanswered questions. They did say that the police should try to give a warning before they use that force, but there was a lot left open, like what kinds of weapons count as weapons that a suspect could have that might justify the use of deadly force, or what kinds of crimes involve the threatened infliction of serious physical harm. I mean, is that just someone who says, like, I could kill you? Is that a serious threat of serious physical harm that would then justify the police shooting a fleeing felon? So that was the first sort of big Supreme Court case. And then 4 years later, they decided a case called Graham versus Connor, which did not involve deadly force, but sort of expanded the lens of the Supreme Court's test for determining when police use of force would be deemed constitutionally unreasonable. Graham was a case in which, again, another African-American man who was a diabetic and needed to get some juice to counteract an insulin reaction went into a convenience store. And he saw there was a line at the cashier, so he left and had a friend drive him home. And there were officers who saw this and deemed the behavior to be suspicious. And so they stopped the car, and Graham was having an insulin reaction and running around the car, and he passes out, but the officer grabs him, throws him on the hood of the car, breaks his foot, cuts his wrist, bruises his forehead, injures his shoulder. And they eventually let him go when they figure out that nothing happened, but he sues and it goes up to the United States Supreme Court, and the court issues what they call the reasonableness test for determining when a police use of force or a police seizure will violate the constitutional restrictions on reasonable uses of force. And so they said, look, like, we're just going to balance like the government's interest here against the nature of the force that was used. And we're going to consider how serious the crime was, whether the suspect posed an immediate threat to the safety of the officers, whether the suspect was resisting. And they put a heavy thumb, I think, on the scale in favor of the officers as part of this test, because they said in the Graham case, we have to take into account that officers are making split-second decisions when they use force as a way of saying we give them a little bit more latitude in this reasonableness balancing. So in the end, this leaves us with a very sort of open-ended standard that the lower courts have to apply. And there are a lot of things missing from that standard. So for example, they never talk about, like, what about the officer's potential culpability? What if the officer escalates the situation or uses pre-seizure conduct that elevates the risk of there being a forceful encounter? Should that be part of the equation? They never talk about a proportionality requirement. I mean, how much force should the officer use in many respects probably should depend on how much force the officer is threatened with. And one would think that's a natural part of this analysis, but it isn't an explicit part of the test. And there's a lot of room for sort of how immediate the nature of the threat to the officers has to be. And so there's a lot left to the lower courts and a thumb in many respects on the scale in favor of the officers as part of the legal test.
Tracy, how do we get from these ideas about reasonableness and the need to consider, you know, split-second decision-making that happens in the field to situations in which officers might, you know, in the case of George Floyd, might kneel on a man's neck for 8 minutes, killing him? Are there things that the court has not taken into account about other structural problems within the justice system?
So the intersection between what Eve was talking about with respect to the balance of the scale being on the side of the officer, right? The intersection between that and race often leads us to situations like George Floyd. So if we're going to apply a reasonableness test, if we're going to generally kind of cloak officers in immunity and give them basically the benefit of the doubt,
in these situations, then that leaves a lot of room for bias, conscious and unbiased, the right to play a role in these types of situations. So for example, of course, we want officers to be able to respond if they feel threatened. But as Eve said, right, they should certainly respond at least proportionately to the threat that is posed. They should be responding, you know, not in a way where a lethal encounter is inevitable. But even that question of when and why officers might feel threatened might have a societal or racial aspect to it or cultural aspect to it that the courts often don't consider in these reasonableness right tests. They take the officer's word for that he or she was threatened by certain actions, and where they might be threatened more by the same action in one community versus another. And how you capture that when you're defining these terms and, you know, and when you're setting these standards for force, you know, I guess we could certainly discuss, but those are some of the dynamics that come into play when you don't talk about, okay, what's the officer's culpability in this? You know what I mean? Was it reasonable for the officer to be, you know, threatened by this action, et cetera? So, you know, we saw this play out in Georgia just a few days ago, mm-hmm. when a young man gotten killed at the Wendy's, right? And obviously there was a scuffle there, and then the young man had fled and turned around and pointed a taser. And so, you know, again, the question is not, you know, was the young man resisting, or even did the officer feel as though, you know, he was in a combative situation or at least a tenuous situation, but was his action necessary under the circumstances?
Right.
Was it proportional to what was going on? He had, you know, the young man had a taser in his hand. And those are the questions that where we need to ask, what role does race and societal, you know, and unconscious bias play in encounters like that?
Eve, did you have something to add there?
Yeah, you can see in the United States Supreme Court the exact blindness to addressing race that Tracy is talking about. I mean, if you just look at the Graham case, so there was an African-American boy who goes into a store, sees a long line and leaves. And the officer thinks there's some sort of suspicious behavior going on there. Why? I mean, if a white person were to walk into a store and see a line and leave, my sense is there probably would not be the same level of suspicion aroused in that officer, that there was implicit bias going on in that case, but it wasn't a main part of the decision. Now, that was back in 1989. And I do think, though we haven't seen the Supreme Court addressing this in a majority opinion sort of head on, we have seen some lower courts that are willing to take into account implicit bias in related conducts, which gives me some hope for ways in which they could do it here. So for example, the High State Court in Massachusetts, in a case called Commonwealth versus Warren, held that when a Black man flees from the police in Boston, that is not necessarily a grounds for reasonable suspicion, given the treatment of the African American population by the Boston Police Department. And so they said, when flight by an African American is part of what the police are trying to use to justify their behavior, we're going to discount that somewhat, given the history of the relationship. We saw a similar ruling out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals with respect to the Seattle Police Department when it comes to flight, that they have said because there was a DOJ investigation of the Seattle Police Department and there was a pattern and practice of racial profiling found, that maybe when a Black man flees from the police there, it is not indicative of the guilt of that individual. It might be a reasonable fear based on past relationships that individual's community has had with police. So if we translated that over to the use of force context, we could think about whether we should look at the officer's conduct through a lens that incorporates knowledge that we all have implicit biases and that they are often triggered in high stress environments like the ones that the police are acting in.
That's absolutely right. And hopefully more and more courts will acknowledge that, because that's the next step in kind of treating this problem, is the actual acknowledgement that it is a problem. But we then have to hope that not only happens in a reactionary way once we get to court after someone has been, you know, assaulted or killed or what have you, but also that it starts to change the culture of law enforcement. And part of that is recognition by the courts that this is an issue. And hopefully that then trickles down to the way the officers are trained and the relationship between police officers in general and minority communities.
You both have experience working in state criminal courts. Did you see evidence that judges were taking police conduct into account in how they handled people's cases, you know, either in terms of thinking how appeals might play out or just in what they were inclined to believe of what law enforcement told them?
I would say in my experience as a public defender, I worked at both the trial and the appellate levels, it was very rare that you would get a judge that was willing to recognize bad police conduct unless there was some sort of affirmative, definitive proof via like a videotape or a audio tape that would demonstrate that the officer had behaved in a way that involved excessive force or brutality. Because I think the knee-jerk reaction of a lot of the judges is you're always going to claim excessive force, and I'm scared of the slippery slope if I start to think about what the police conduct looks like and what the lines should be. And they don't know where to draw those lines. So my experience was, unless there was sort of smoking gun evidence, I didn't have judges who were very receptive to arguments about police misconduct or use of force.
So, and the bulk of my practice, I was an appellate attorney. I worked for the Appellate Defender's Office in Michigan and then for the DC Public Defender. And I don't remember very often, if ever, and Eve's experience may be more recent than mine, having police misconduct or the actions of the police play a big role in my cases. I mean, I've had cases overturned because of judicial misconduct during the case, but there seems to be this notion that, again, the police officers are given the benefit of the doubt and that the defendant has found him or herself there through their own actions, right? And then we can kind of start with how they were treated in the court system, but very rarely did we kind of look behind that to say, how did they get there in the first place and what happened during that investigation and arrest?
Mm-hmm. And what you'll see actually in criminal courts is that a lot of times when you have a suspect who has been injured by the police, that there's almost always some sort of resisting arrest charge that the officer will put onto the suspect in that case. And there will be testimony by the officer about how the officer was threatened in some way, or there was some perceived use of force that necessitated the officer to respond using the amount of force that resulted in the injury. And these tend to be rather sort of like what the officer said versus what the suspect says, unless you have documentary evidence. And whenever you have a swearing contest between someone accused of a crime and an officer with a badge, the court often tends to credit the officer with the badge. So that's why I think the social media capturing of what officers have been doing is part of like a vitally important educational effort to demonstrate what's going on and to sort of aid suspects in the credibility battle that they had been losing in the courts up until that point, even though the conduct was probably the same.
I absolutely agree with that. I think that social media and the use of video and that kind of thing has been crucial, because the place where we found ourselves is that we are educating young Black men about how to interact with the police, as opposed to educating officers about their conduct, right? We're telling our sons, make sure if you get stopped, you got to do this, and make sure you know, comply, and make sure you don't do anything that might be considered resistant, et cetera. You know, and obviously we as citizens should be good citizens, but we're going over and above to teach our sons not to provoke police officers, as opposed to kind of putting some of that onus on the police officers, on the police departments, on law enforcement, to make sure that their officers are educated about a broad range of things, about the appropriate use of force, about unconscious bias, et cetera.
It's certainly possible to find sworn officers who agree that changes in culture would be appropriate at this point. And police are keenly aware that they're putting their own safety at risk every day. It's frightening for them and their families to think about this and to contemplate a world where they have to cede some ground in how they think about their own safety. What would make it possible to get buy-in from law enforcement, in your views, about how this should work?
Well, you're talking about effectuating a cultural change in a lot of police departments around the country. And part of the problem is that you need to hire officers who buy into the revised mission. I think that's part of the argument for defunding certain departments and starting over. You know, when we look at various Department of Justice studies, they explain that, you know, half or more, right, of the police academies around the country train their officers in an environment that is predominantly stress-based. It's like a militaristic form of training. Mm-hmm. And that, not surprisingly, conditions officers to feel like they're going into a war zone. And to encourage them to be on guard. Now, of course, we want them to be protective of themselves, but if they're looking for violence or they're expecting to see violence, they're going to be more vigilant and more likely to see it. So part of it is like there's a different form of training that can happen, which is much more of a community policing form of training that is not stress-based and militaristic in its orientation. And those departments tend to have like a much more, we are here as servants of the community to try and help in lots of ways, not just to stop crime. And so if you have much more of that social worker kind of orientation, it's a different mentality, but it also attracts a different person to the job. That cultural change has to come from high up within a department, and whoever is in the leadership of the department has to look for and find the right people and promote that messaging through training on implicit bias, community support, et cetera, and also through supervision to ensure that that's actually how the officers are enacting their mission on the streets and creating a relationship with the communities that they serve. That's a big shift in a lot of places from where we currently are.
Tracy Brame, with that in mind, how do you see legal precedent fitting together with the other factors that influence police conduct, like training and hiring and recruitment?
Well, you know, I think that Eve has mentioned you see somewhat of a trend toward courts at least acknowledging the role that race and culture and other factors can play in these kinds of encounters. In my class this morning, I teach race at the Supreme Court, and we were talking about the Dred Scott case that, you know, in the 1850s announced that Black people could never be citizens of the United States. And obviously, you know, we've come a long way since then. But one of the things we talked about was the importance of the court's words, of how those words certainly affected Dred Scott and his wife in that case, but how they also even affect us to that day of having the highest court in the land make a pronouncement like that about a whole class of people and what that's meant for the descendants of those folks. And so similarly, I think that if we can continue to get courts along with other sectors of our community to understand that and start to hold officers accountable to it. So, you know, to certainly provide the training, to build trust with communities and things like that, but maybe adjusting qualified immunity protections, you know, having a real conversation about the use of excessive force and the role that bias plays in it so that we're, you know, not only certainly training the officers, but also holding them accountable when something happens that could have been avoided, but also having the appropriate reaction when these things happen.
Tracy Brame is an associate dean at Western Michigan University's Cooley Law School, Grand Rapids campus. We've also been talking today with Eve Primus, professor of law at University of Michigan Law School. Ladies, thank you so much both for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.